as part of this meditation, I often mention things like the nimittas, the beautiful lights, the razzmatazz, which comes into the mind, and also the jhanas. They're an important part of the meditation. And even though some of you may think, oh, I've only started meditation, no chance for me to get any jhanas, I can't even watch my breath yet. What chance is there? Don't ever think like that. Because sometimes jhanas creep up on you. And when you're least expecting you, they grab you, and you get this amazing, wonderful experiences. Who knows when they're going to come next? But it's true that on these retreats, sometimes the most unlikely people get these jhanas. So, you can't sometimes say, oh, my meditation's been terrible. No way. Sometimes they just come out of the blue. And you never know when they're going to come to you. So it's good that I talk about these things. One of the other reasons I talk about the jhanas, you know, in reasonable detail, was an event which happened in Penang many years ago. I was teaching a retreat there, and the organizers, we had our interviews. They said, can you squeeze this one woman into the interview sessions? Because she's been going to see psychologists and therapists and psychiatrists, and no one could find out what's wrong with her, and she thinks she's crazy. So, I'm like the last resort psychologist when everyone else fails. And usually I fail as well, but every now and again, you get it right. And this was one of those cases, because not knowing what had happened, she came into the room and said, what happened? Describe it to me. And then she went on to describe, a classical jhana experience. And she didn't know what it was. She just got blissed out of her head, couldn't feel her body, having enormous power and energy. And when she came out afterwards, she felt totally different, and she thought she had some sort of mental breakdown. It's because she couldn't understand what it was, she thought she was crazy. And it was such a wonderful thing for me to hear this, because then I said, ma'am, you just had a jhana. That's a jhana experience. And then I added some of the extra details which she had missed. I said, yes, yes, that was it, that was it. So she went away a very happy lady. Now, she wasn't crazy at all. She just had one of the most powerful experiences of her life, and she didn't understand what the hell it was. So she needed someone to tell her, and she knew that I knew, and that it was a jhana, so she went away a happy person. She can't do it again, but at least she got one to see what they were like. Maybe later on she'd be able to do that, a sort of spontaneous letting go. And those things do happen. So, and it's also, it gives you the overview of meditation. So you don't just look at the early part of meditation, just relaxing and being peaceful. You actually find out where this actually goes, where it leads to. So it fills in the whole picture of what meditation is. The example I gave on the first or second day of the lotus is very helpful. You're opening up the lotus, and you do that on a retreat. You start off tired, and you have to sleep a lot. So you're just opening up things. You're going with kindness and with mindfulness, opening everything up. And I did mention there are standard stages. Not everyone goes through the same stages, but they're pretty sort of standard. Present moment awareness and silence and seeing the breath. Sometimes you do the breath first and then present moment awareness and silence. But those have to actually come up sooner or later. You have to be in this moment, so you're not off in the future or the past, and because you're happy being here. And that happiness is part of this meditation, and I mentioned something yesterday. You build up energy into this moment, and you feel very happy just being here. And you get to the stage of the delightful breath, which I've mentioned, just breathing in, breathing out. You're just so happy just watching a breath. You don't really want to go anywhere else in the whole world. This is the time when the bell goes, you just don't want to get up to go to lunch. You're just happy being here. Now, that's not that difficult a state to be in, just totally content, just breathing in, breathing out, a very simple mental object, but very happy and content. It's a certain flavor of happiness. Now, with happiness, there are many flavors. And I use the word flavor because in English, we just got one or two words. We're happy, we're joyful, we're excited. But there's thousands of different types of happiness, and unfortunately we haven't got the language for it. So I just say different flavours, like ice cream has different flavours, you know, chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, whatever else you like, but it has different flavours, but it's all ice cream, it's all happiness, but just different flavours. And as you go deeper in the meditation, the flavours become more refined and also more intense as well. You know, they're more enjoyable the deeper you go into this meditation. So I'm going to start with, you know, the delightful breath. Now the reason why that's important is that when you have a delightful breath, the happiness means you don't have to put any more effort in, and the mind doesn't wander off. The job of the happiness is actually to keep you still. And you all know that. If you're having a happy time, you don't want to move. You don't want to leave. You know, you're enjoying this. You want it to keep going on. But if it's not happy, you have to put some effort if you want to be still, to stop yourself going anywhere. As soon as the happiness starts to develop, you know, the past and the future, and even the thoughts, they can hardly come up at all. You can hear the thoughts, but they're over there somewhere. You know, you can hear the sounds, but you know, they're way over there because you're really focused, because you're enjoying yourself. It's a happiness which is a glue, which sticks your attention onto the object. It's a happy object. So, once it starts to get the delightful breath, because you don't have to put any effort in, naturally you become more and more still. The effort, the doing, which shakes the water, which makes the waves, is not required anymore. So, you know, you just don't do any effort at all. You're just happy just being here. And because of that stillness, the energy gets greater, the happiness increases. Not only the happiness increases, but the awareness increases. You get this self-supporting feedback loop. You know, the happiness makes more mindfulness, the mindfulness creates more happiness, the happiness creates more mindfulness. They actually build up together. So you get very mindful, very aware, and very happy, and obviously very still as well. And because it's very still, and because the mindfulness is very strong, you find that you don't notice a difference between an in-breath and an out-breath. The best simile actually comes from the commentaries on Buddhism, where obviously one meditation teacher, maybe 1500 years ago, was describing just how you saw a log of wood. When you start sawing a log of wood, you can see the handle of the saw and the tip of the saw and the piece of wood which you're sawing. But as you focus in, the handle of the saw disappears, the tip disappears, and you only see a few centimeters just where the saw tooth hits the wood. That's where you focus in, where the action is. So you focus again, you only see a tiny bit of the saw. And that's exactly what happens with the breath. You don't see the beginning of an in-breath or the end of an in-breath. You just see this tiny bit of breath happening right now. And you can't really distinguish whether that is the middle of the breath or the beginning or the end of the breath. No more than you can know a sawtooth, whether it's at the tip end or the handle end or somewhere in between, because they all look the same. You don't even know whether it's an in or out breath. It's just breath happening right now. Now this isn't important to understand because you don't know in or out, beginning or end, everything is even and the same. That means that your breath can vanish, it can disappear at last. And for those of you whose breath have vanished, you ask all these questions, I was scared. For goodness sake, do not be scared. This is what is supposed to happen. This is what we meditate for the breath to disappear. Because when the breath disappears, with it goes the whole body, the five senses, that's the last thing which turns off, and now you're in the realm of the mind. The purpose of the meditation is to calm everything down, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touch, so those five senses can disappear, so you can find out what this mind truly is. And the body is one hard thing to let go of, so what we do, basically in brief, we've got the whole body with all its itches and aches and coughs and everything else. So we focus on one thing, just the breath. Everything else disappears. We focus on the breath. And afterwards, we let go of the breath. The breath is like a stepping stone. You know, we've still got part of the body left by watching the breath. But once the breath becomes so smooth and even, that disappears too. and then we're on the other side. We haven't got anybody anymore to bother us. All we got now is our mind. And as we got that mind, the way it appears to most people is a beautiful light. This is just how people experience the mind. Obviously, just the mind is not a light. It's just the way we perceive. And that is because our brain spends more capacity on seeing, on visual objects, than anything else. We are visual animals. We know our world, we know our food, we know our friends through sight more than anything else. Which is why in the passport you have a picture of your face. You don't have your smell. And they can just, you know, put some scratchy smell and smell. Oh, yeah, that's Dania. Oh, that's Nero Kebuchara. You don't do that on passport. Well, you could, or the sound of your voice. You know, and a passport, you can just press a little button and have the sound of the voice. Is that the person in front of me? If you were very, very skilled at the sense of sound, you probably will be distinguished who's who by the way they speak, by their sound. But on, obviously, passports, we have photos because that is usually the way we recognize each other. And we spend so much time seeing things, much more than hearing, smelling, tasting, or touching. That is why that the visual sense is the dominant one for most human beings. Which also means that when we see our mind, we see it usually as a visual object. The only reason it's light and is because by this time your mind is usually very powerful. So it's a brilliant light. And also very beautiful as well. When the real nimittas come up, they're incredibly beautiful and they're very brilliant. When people come up and tell me, those are the couple of things which I look for. Yeah, there are other nimittas when you see a sheet of light. It's not very bright. They count as nimittas. You're seeing your mind, but it's not really ready. It's not the real stage when the body has disappeared. You've got your happiness and energy up, and then you see these beautiful, powerful lights. Yes, sometimes people close their eyes and they can see lights as soon as they close their eyes, but that's more a physiological thing rather than a nimitta stuff. The real nimitta is you're very peaceful and this beautiful light comes up. Now, that's a sign that you are getting to that stage of meditation where you just can see your mind. And first of all, usually it can be a complicated nimitta. By complicated, I mean a whole scenario of lakes or people or trees and stuff like that, because you have complicated minds. But if it comes at the right time, it'll be beautiful. As long as it's beautiful, great, you can make use of that. If it's a complicated vision, all you need to do is to go to the most beautiful part of that vision. If you see a tree, there'll be some leaf on one of those trees which got a little dewdrop which is twinkling, which is sparkling. If there's some sort of river, there's always one little part of it which reflects the sun, you know, the twinkle on the surface of the water. That sort of thing you go to, the twinkle, the brilliant, the beautiful part. And what happens if you just focus on that? Sometimes you do that as an act of will. Yeah, you're disturbing it, but it's a complicated thing, so you don't mind to disturb it a tiny bit. You focus on that, and straight away, that spark will just, It amplifies, and you'll just have this beautiful, bright nimitta instead of a complicated one. If any of you have got very negative minds, or you're very afraid of something, you might see the monster nimitta. Ooh, right in front of you. Now, I have to say this because there's so many Asians here, and so you're so scared sometimes of nothing. But this is how you deal if you see a monster in your meditation, with tongue hanging out, ooh, and big bulging eyes, and sharp teeth dripping blood, and necklaces of skulls and spiky hair. Ooh. Because that happened to me once. Only once. And I like telling this story because this shows how you deal with such things. It's not the object is the problem, but your relationship, how you respond to it. So there I was meditating, and this big monster right in front of me. You know, just not my eyes closed, it's like a mental object. You know, big tongue, all those things, sharp hair and teeth and everything, but really angry and just big bulging eyes, all red. And so what did I do? I know this is like a reflection of my mind. I can actually do something with this. I can mess around with it. It's not outside of me, it's actually inside of me. So I've got some power. So what I did, first of all, that his eyes were pretty scary. So I put on a pair of Ray-Ban sunglasses. All I needed to do was to think it. And then there was this Ray-Ban sunglasses over this monster's eyes. It looked really cool. And the next thing, it had these sharp teeth. So just like I used to do at school, you know, naughty schoolboy doodling, you know, black out a few of its teeth, so I needed to go and see the monster dentist. And then I put a straw hat on its head, a cigarette coming out of its mouth, a flower in the straw hat. And the corners of its mouth I made go up, so it was like smiling at me. And if you've ever seen like a monster with Ray-Bans, a straw hat with a flower, and a cigarette coming out of its mouth, but you know, smiling, it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen in my life. I laughed, and at that the monster vanished and never came back again. I humiliated it. And some years ago, there was a man who was staying over the road at Bodhidharma Monastery on a sort of little retreat by himself for maybe a week. And he must have had some sort of, you know, schizophrenic tendencies, because he came up to me really concerned. In every one of the paving bricks, you know, outside the kitchen and everywhere else in Bodhidharma Monastery, these monsters would appear out of the bricks at him. And of course he was really scared. So I told him my story. I said, yeah, when a monster comes out, play around with it. You know, just put hats on it, put a top hat or something, and a monocle like an English lord. And so he did that. And I saw him later on in the afternoon, evening. He said, I had such a wonderful day. I've never had so much fun in my whole life, just playing around with these monsters and dressing them up and all sorts of weird stuff. And he said, after a couple of hours, they just disappeared. They didn't come back again. That is actually how you deal with these things, with fun, not fear. Fear, you feed them. Fun, messing around, and you find all the fear and all the stuff which actually feeds them just disappears, and they're just gone. So if ever you have a scary monster come into your meditation, play around with it, humiliate it, make fun of it. Nothing gets rid of monsters more than when you don't respect and get afraid with them. If you don't get afraid, they just go to the next room and try and scare someone else, because you're no fun. So please humiliate them. Consider the creations of the mind. So you've created them, you can create whatever you like out of any monster which comes up into your mind. So if those limiters come up, you can have enormous fun. Wow, great, thanks. But obviously the beautiful limiters are the ones we really, really want to sort of develop. Now these are just what happens when you become still. It's a little bit of negativity and fear which you develop, just like in dreams. That just makes the monsters. If you have lots of positive energy, lots of kindness, lots of joy, you never get those negative images in the first place. Because your mind is pure, positive, joyful, then of course when you see the mind the first time, that's what you see, this pure, beautiful mind of yours. And don't think that your mind isn't pure and beautiful. The very fact that you've managed to come on this retreat, you're keeping precepts, you're kind, you know, you're the cream of the crop who managed to actually have enough good karma to get on a good meditation retreat. You are reasonably good people. Yeah, you're not the best. You've all done naughty things in your life. But put it in perspective and you're pretty good people. Otherwise you wouldn't be coming into a place like this. So you're really good people. You've got a lot of good karma. So when actually these nimittas come up, you usually see very beautiful lights. If you have been naughty and you have just, you know, broken your precepts and done stupid things, when your nimitta comes up, it's not beautiful. It's like dirty, like a cloth which hasn't been washed. And I told that story. I remember this one fellow is quite well known in Malaysia. I won't say who he is because, you know, you'd know him if I mentioned the name. And when I said this, first of all, he just couldn't wait to speak to me afterwards. And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, I'm really upset. What happened?" He said, "I had an imitator and you wouldn't believe how grubby it was." And he said, "What have you been doing?" "Yeah, that's the problem, Ajahn Brahm. I'm sorry." I don't know what he'd been up to, but he'd been misbehaving. And so, and this is what happens. You see, like a grubby imitator. You're seeing your own mind, and you cannot deceive yourself. So if it's a grubby mind, get your precepts together, for goodness sake. Be kind, be forgiving, and don't sort of cheat other people, and don't play around outside your marriage, whatever it is. Because if you do, the limiter comes up, it's grubby. But most of you don't do that, I hope. So so when your limiter comes, it's very beautiful. And because it's beautiful, because it's powerful, that is where you get the two problems of nimittas. One is excitement and the other one is fear. Those are the two ones to look out for. Excitement because it's, yes, at last, I've got nimitta. And as soon as you react like that, of course the nimitta comes because your mind is still, you're peaceful, and you go and disturb it. You don't do that. Instead, you keep calm. Or fear. The fear comes up, I mentioned that earlier, because you're going to places you've never been before. This is weird stuff. For those of you who like weird stuff, and I put my hand up, I always love weird stuff. Now, I told a story of that my friend in the Buddhist Society, Bernard Carr, Professor of Physics at London, he retired now. But he was interested in psychic research. So we used to go to houses together for search for ghosts. Now, a lot of you, if you heard there was a ghost in a house, you'd run the other way. Not me. I'd go there, find out, you know, to see what's going on there. Because, you know, I was interested in weird stuff. I was a physicist. I wanted to find out about what's happening in life. Actually, this is not joke ghost story, real ghost stories. Because, you know, that one the other night about the coffin ghost, that was totally made up. It never happened. It's a good story. You may have heard it before, but I don't care. I really love telling it, as you can probably see, just the energy and effort I put into telling that story. But this was when I was monk, 6 years, 5 years, and I was actually wandering in Thailand, doing what they call tudong, when you go from place to place, you know, looking for the great teachers or finding nice caves to meditate in. And I went to see a monk called Ajahn Suwat. He was a disciple, senior disciple of Ajahn Phan, one of the forest masters. And he was staying in Tum Si Gael, I remember the name of the monastery, in Phupan, the mountains, so maybe about 60 kilometers south of Sakonakon. And I stayed there for a couple of days, a really nice monk. And I was actually walking. I had a decision to walk everywhere in Thailand instead of taking any lifts whatsoever. So even though he invited me, he said, "No, I can take you to Sakonakon." I said, "No, I want to walk." You know, to keep an old tradition of that, the wandering monks who just go on foot. But I asked him, he said, "Is there any place, 60 kilometers is too far to walk in one day. Is there a nice place halfway? Especially caves. I love caves." And he said, "Yes, there is a cave there, but be careful because there's a ghost in it." Really? And I wasn't scared, I was actually excited. Really great. Because when, like, a monk of that stature says there's a ghost, there is a ghost there. It can't mean that there's only sort of a superstition. No, because monks aren't superstitious. If there's a ghost, there's a real ghost there. So, great, I'm going to see a ghost tonight. So I went, he told me the village, told me where it was. I got there, met one of the villagers, they said, "I'll be there on arms out in the morning. Can I find that cave?" And he took me into the cave. It was the most spooky cave you could ever imagine. There was like old Buddha statues which were ancient. They're probably worth a fortune in some museum. And I asked the layperson, he said, "Yes, if you go deeper in the cave, there's a skeleton. Somebody had died or was murdered in that cave." And, you know, he didn't actually say that was the ghost, but he left before it got dark. So there I was, in the mountains of Phupan, late at night, dark, no electricity, no people for a couple of kilometers, alone, waiting for the ghost. How would you feel? Would you be scared? Not me, I was excited. Yes, ghost, come on. That's how crazy a monk I was. So I was meditating there, meditating and meditating. No sign of any ghost. I don't know, 9, 10 o'clock or something. I've been walking all day. I was really exhausted. Come on, ghost, I want to go to bed. That's actually how I felt. I'm not exaggerating. So, no ghost. So you lay down and you covered yourself up with your robe to go to sleep. And as soon as I lay down, bah, 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 something came running right towards me and stopped right next to me. It was a ghost. You know what I did? I said, this is not on. You come when I want you to. Don't come now. Get away. And that was it. The ghost went. This is something you should know. The ghost will follow orders. If they don't come at the right time, scold them and then they have to go. So then the ghost, look, if you want to come, come at the right time. I've been inviting you all this time. And as soon as I go to bed, then you come. That is not on. You should respect me much more. Get out of here. So that was the ghost in the Phupan Mountains in Sakonikon. You don't have to be scared. But, you know, for me, it's more like excitement, because I'm not scared of sort of weird stuff. You know, you're interested in it. So if a nimitta comes up, yeah, it's a bit weird, it's a bit strange, but it's perfectly safe. It's what's supposed to happen, so don't be afraid. And also, don't be excited, because if you work so hard to get this, and now it's here, don't spoil it. Let it be. The reason why that nimitta has come up is because you have been kind. You have been mindful, you have been peaceful, you've let go, and now you've got something. All this hard work of meditation, and now something's happened. Don't throw it away. Just carry on being aware, being kind. That's all. So easy to do. But don't do anything more. Just be kind. This little nimitta comes up. Ah, so good of you to come. And with that peacefulness and that kindness, of course, that nimitta, that light, stays. It doesn't go all over the place. It doesn't sort of keep changing shape. It stabilizes. The reason is because you are quiet. Because you are still, the nimitta is still. It's just a reflection of your mind. If your mind is anxious, if it's scared, of course, it takes away the purity of the nimitta and it just vanishes. If your mind is agitated through excitement, it goes all over the place and it vanishes. You just have to keep still. Don't do anything. There's one of the husbands of one of the Thai girls, one of the people who always keeps 8 precepts. I like telling the story. He was a photographer for the local newspaper. And nothing much happens in Perth, so it's a pretty boring job. Except one time in his life, as a photographer, he had his moment of excitement, his day of success, where his photograph got syndicated throughout the whole world as he got his scoop. He only gets one in a lifetime. What had happened is the Australian pop singer Kylie Minogue, she had disappeared. The rumor was she was stressed out, had a nervous breakdown, and had gone to hide away from everywhere. And the rumor was, it's only a rumor, she was hiding out in Cable Beach Resort in Broome. And just on the off chance the rumor was true, the newspaper sent this photographer, Kerry, up to Cable Beach Resort to see if he could get the photograph of Kylie Minogue. And he said he had to, you know, climb over the fence. Because he couldn't go to reception and say, is Kylie Minogue here? You know, of course they wouldn't tell you if she was there. So, you know, he climbed over the fence and went crawling through the bushes as quietly as possible. Because if any other guest saw him there, they'd think it's some thief and call the security. Or if it really was Kylie Minogue and she actually saw a photographer, Of course, you'd run into a room and hide for the rest of the day and maybe try and go to another resort to hide. And he was crawling through the bushes quietly and as mindfully as possible. He said he'd never been as mindful in his whole life. And then he went to one sort of cabin or something, and he saw someone who, maybe that was her. It looked similar from a distance. So he crawled very carefully to get closer and closer. And as he got closer, it was her. And he had his camera. He had to very mindfully pick up his camera. Because any mistake, any noise, any rustle of any leaf, she would have seen. And he would have lost his photograph of his career. And he picked up his camera. Click. He got it. Okay, it's a bit unfair for poor Kylie Minogue. But, that's what happens when you're sort of a celebrity like that. But he said he had to, all those teachings I'd given him about being mindful, not disturbing, not getting excited. Oh, can't even, oh. He had to follow those teachings and he got his photograph. Now, if he could do that, surely he can do it with Nimitta's. Nimitta's here. You're shot of a lifetime. Don't make any noise. No excitement. Don't do anything. And then it stays. And once it gets stable, because it's not moving, it picks up energy. So that nimitta gets brighter and brighter. Now you're really having fun. If you really want to bliss out. Now, even this, and there's much more blisses to come yet, but this is, you're starting off with bliss better than sex. This is huge. Whoa. I can't really just describe it, but it's incredible ecstasy. Your really mind is really happy, really blissed out. Because it's nice and still and the energy bliss comes up. That nimitta, the light, becomes very beautiful. It does not matter what color it is. I know some people say, no, the best one is blue. Some say the best one is orange, gold, white, or purple. It just doesn't matter at all. You add the color. What is really important is its brilliance, its beauty. And you'll notice if it is, say, a gold, it's not a gold you can see in the real world. It's like you take the color gold and you take it further. Not a gold you can really see in the real world, but more gold than gold could ever be. More blue, more deep blue than any blue you could ever see in the sky. And that's a good sign of nimittas. It's a mental object, pure, deep, incredibly beautiful, like nothing you've ever seen in your whole life, and a lot of happiness and joy. The sort of happiness and joy, very intense, but very still. Sometimes you think things which are powerful can't be still. They can. These nimittas. Incredible power, but very, very still and focused. So, there you are having the time of your life. Literally. Actually, no, that's not literally. It's time of many lives. And then, when it's ready, you don't do anything. This is just what happens. If you get still and still, the other lotus leaf opens up. And now you're into the jhana. And again, if you thought the nimitta was weird, this is even more weird, like you've never experienced ever before. Totally different. And it's so different, you're so focused. In the jhanas, you can't think, you can't describe these states to yourself at the time because you're too still to make any descriptions. Remember, to describe things to yourself, you have to have some wit, to be able to look at it this way, look at it that way, and to talk it over with yourself. You're just gathering this incredible data. Later on, you'll be able to understand what it is. While you're in there, you're just gathering the data. You can't move, you can't do anything, you're just in this incredible state. Only afterwards, when you come out, then you sort of look back. It's a very powerful experience. You can't forget it. It's very easy to look back and see, wow, what was that? And you'll notice the main object of any jhana, you say, what was I aware of, was just bliss. Ecstasy, joy. And if you want to understand a simile for that, somebody gave me a little card. expressing that simile was one I found years ago. I haven't said it for a long time now, although it's in the book. The simile of the Cheshire Cat. The Cheshire Cat was a simile in Alice Through the Looking Glass, I think. In Alice Through the Looking Glass, Lewis Carroll, thank you. Charles Dodgson, that was his real name. So Lewis Carroll, Alice Through the Looking Glass. Alice saw this cat sitting on a tree. And then suddenly the cat vanished. And then it came back again. And Alice said something like, "It gives me a headache seeing cats coming and going so fast. If you're going to disappear, can't you disappear a bit slowly?" And so the cat said, "Okay." And so the cat, first of all, its legs disappeared. And its little tail, leaving just the body and the head. Then the body vanished, leaving only the smiling head. And then the ears vanished, and the whiskers vanished. And lastly, the whole head vanished, leaving only the smile. And Alice said, "This is weird. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never before seen a smile without a cat." And when I read that, I thought, yes, that is a beautiful description of the jhanas. So you've got a nimitta, which is smiling, which is happy, which is joyful. You've got something on which happiness is written and expressed. Now all you've got left is the happiness, the bliss, with no light, no nimitta, just a smile, with no cat to do the smiling. Just happiness. That is your object, nothing else. Now that's a very nice description. Yeah, it is weird, because when you try and imagine in this real world, how can you have a smile without lips and a face to have a smile on? It's impossible. But this is actually the truth of what you experience in these states. Happiness without anything being happy. That's a very good description. And this just occurs. Again, if you want these states to happen, they never happen. This is one of the problems, certainly occurred to me and occurred to so many other people. If you ever have a good experience in meditation, a really deep one, you're really blissed out, be careful, because it is natural. You'll want it back again. And it's because you want to re-experience that state is why it will never come back. This is my experience, other monks' experience. If you get a deep meditation once, I can't get it back again. What's going on? And it's just that one cause, I want it back. So the antidote to that is, you use this great Buddhist philosophy, it's something which covers everything in Buddhism. You don't just look at a thing. You look, where does it come from? What's its causes? What gives rise to these states? Once you know the causes, then your job in meditation is just to recreate the causes. And don't even think about the result. Just the causes, not the result. A gross simile, when you go home, and you see all the dishes needed to be washed, and you think, "Oh, when are the dishes going to be washed? I want to wash the dishes. When are the dishes going to be clean and sparkling like they were before?" If you keep thinking like that, the dishes never get clean. So instead, you think, clean dishes. What's the cause of clean dishes? And the insight comes, washing up. So you put the causes into place. You wash up the dishes. And then you wash, and then, hey presto, all the dishes are clean and sparkling again. Because you never focus on the results, you focus on the causes. So instead of thinking, when's my nimitta going to come up again? When am I getting into jhana? When am I going to see a nimitta? When am I going to get into jhana? That's just like saying, when are the dishes going to be clean? Instead of saying, what causes nimitta to come? What causes jhana? What causes the clean dishes washing up? So I could do some washing up. What are the causes for nimitta and jhana? Kindness and mindfulness and nothing else. Being peaceful, being still. That's the causes. So if ever you have a deep experience, please don't make my mistake and so many other people's mistakes, which cost you so much frustration for quite a few years. Remember the quarters. Stillness, 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 kindness. Just being aware, not doing anything. So that's what you do, and these things come in due course. When there's enough stillness, the stillness is so strong, of course these things happen naturally. That's just all you do, you just keep as many moments of stillness as you possibly can put together in a row. Still, 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 moment after moment after moment, until the stillness is so solid, so strong, of course the nimittas, they have to come up. The jhanas, they have to happen, it's just natural course. So in the jhanas, sometimes these days, when I first started teaching jhanas, there was a lot of resistance from a lot of people saying jhanas aren't necessary for enlightenment. They're too difficult anyway. Isn't there an easy way without the jhanas? And you only have to look in the Buddha's teachings to know the jhanas are the easy way to enlightenment. And basically there's no other way. That's why it is part of the Eightfold Path, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's always jhanas. As I mentioned, the Gopika Moggallana Sutta, number 108, Majjhima Nikaya, when they ask what type of meditation did the Buddha praise and recommend, you look there and it says first jhana, fourth, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. It's just jhana, 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 jhana taught by the Buddha. They are important. The reason is because you're still enough. That is a minimal level of stillness required. Never call it concentration, stillness. And this is just what happens when you are that still. It's natural. And it'll come sooner or later when you practice meditation properly. So it's really important. Now, in those jhanas, okay, there's four jhanas. What are the difference between them? And again, the difference between them is a different flavor of bliss. And the bliss has a different flavor because of its cause. The first jhana, it's the bliss. It actually says this very beautifully in the suttas, especially Potapada Sutta. It is the bliss born of being apart from the five senses and the body. Your five senses have gone. No seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting. You can't even feel your body anymore. It's gone. Oh, that is incredible freedom. Like you haven't experienced ever because your body is always there irritating you. It's like having five kids who will never leave you alone. There's a little funny story about this I told in Nolamara some time ago, but it's worth teaching. Talking about, because sometimes the talks are too serious. A little bit of fun here, but it fits in very well. A woman came home from the shops one day. She had her arms full of the groceries. As she opened the door, a dog rushed right past her and went into her house. It wasn't her dog. But the dog just invaded her house. And so, you know, she couldn't stop the dog because she had her arms full. So she immediately, you know, kicked the door shut and put the shopping down and went to find the dog and found the dog, a beautiful Labrador, very clean, not a stray dog, had a collar on, curled up, fast asleep in the corner of one of her rooms. It wasn't doing anybody any harm, it was just having a nap in her house. And so she was, you know, kind enough, it looked a beautiful dog, oh, why do I need to disturb the dog? She just let it sleep for 2 hours. And then the dog got up, you know, a very light bark, so she let it out. Her house. She hadn't got a clue who owned it, where it came from, what it was doing. But the same thing happened the next day. Now, about the same time when she came back, the dog was waiting for her. As soon as she opened the door, rushed right past her, into the house, into the same corner of the room, curled up, and went to sleep. And she was actually, you know, people like dogs. I like dogs and cats. If they want to do that, fine. And then she quite liked the dog. It was very sweet and beautiful. But after 4 or 5 days, the same thing happened. About the same time in the afternoon, the dog coming in, go to the corner of its room, even though it didn't own the house, didn't know who the heck the dog was, and went asleep. So she wanted to know where this dog came from or what it was doing. So she had this great idea. She got a piece of paper, wrote out a note, said, "I don't know who this dog is or where it comes from, but it's been coming into my house every afternoon for a nap, for a sleep, in this corner of the room. I don't mind at all because I like dogs, and it's clean, it's well behaved, it's no problem at all. It's welcome to come again. But I just want to know why and where it comes from." And so after 2 hours sleep, you know, the dog went carrying the note. The next day when it came, there was another note, you know, tucked in its collar. And she read it and said, "This is my dog." Said, "It lives just, you know, just a couple of streets away. It lives in a home with 5 children, 2 of which are under 5 years of age, and a wife who's always nagging, 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 nagging. It obviously comes into your house to get some peace and quiet. Can I come too?" Sorry, the husband. So you can really feel for a dog with about 5 kids always pestering it, especially when they're young kids. The poor dog can't have any rest. So it runs into somebody else's house. I find the quiet corner, right, that's it, I'm sleeping. And the husband says, "Could I please come as well?" Now that's, you can imagine 5 children pestering you, your poor dog. You can understand the meaning of that symbol. This is the 5 senses, always pestering you. And so you want to find a nice place where you can have a rest. You go into Jhana land, where at last you can have some rest from these pestering 5 senses. You know, always my nose is itching because I always suffer from hay fever. Something is scratching. I have to go to the toilet. I need a glass of water. Wah! These 5 senses really pester you. But when they disappear totally, oh, you're so free. It feels so good. It's scary because you think, I'm not aware of my body. Someone can pick me up and put me in a truck and take me away, and they could. What can happen to me? But I reassure you, there's lots of stories about people who get into these jhanas who can't feel the body and just how invulnerable they are. The story in the sutras is of this monk. He was meditating in jhanas in the forest, and these 2 lay people, they're Buddhists. They were in the forest collecting mushrooms or sticks or something, and they saw this monk perfectly still. They thought he was dead, because in jhana you're so still, you know, you touch a person, you know, nothing happens. If you were a doctor, you know, open their eyes and put the light in, nothing would move, because, you know, your 5 senses are shut down. So it looks like you're dead, but you're not dead. So they thought he was dead, and they were very, very devout Buddhists. So they thought, it's not right to leave, you know, a holy monk, you know, to be eaten by the jungle animals. We have to give him a proper funeral. And they were in the forest, so it was easy to collect some wood. So it only took them 30 minutes, you know, to build a nice funeral pyre. And they put the monk on the top. And they did, you know, whatever chanting they could remember. I mean, it's probably not the right one, but who cares, it was some chanting. And then they, you know, they lit the fire. And when they knew the fire was lit and it wouldn't go out, they didn't actually wait for the whole body to be cremated, because they were busy. They had things to do. They'd already wasted an hour or two, you know, on this cremation. So they went off to do their stuff. And of course, the next morning, the monk came in on arms round into the village. Not even his robes were charred. And they were very impressed. And that's a story told by the Buddha. That's what happens. If you do get into jhanas, and we do make a mistake, and we take you to the crematorium. The guy who runs the crematorium, he'll be probably the next one in the box. He'll probably die of shock when they open the ovens after the burning, and you come out, "Hi, me again." I'm just in jhana, that's all. That's what happens. Now that is the story from the past. The story from the present, personal experience. There was this Indonesian monk I knew a long time ago. I don't mind saying it now, because 38 years ago. We try and keep these things quiet so no monk, you know, actually gets famous because of these abilities. So we never actually say ourselves what we've done. But this particular monk, he was Indonesian, and he really did have some psychic powers. I remember one of the people I knew very, very well, she was a Thai layperson, that he was teaching meditation classes in Wat Bawan. And she said she was meditating with this Indonesian monk. She knew that something was happening, and she opened her eyes and said, "This is absolutely truth." He said, "I wouldn't lie to you, Ajahn Brahm. This is what was happening." From his eyes there were two rays of light coming right into hers. She could see those rays of light. And he said it was like some super person in the movies, but it was real. So you know, there's real psychic powers, great, aren't they? But anyway, you know, I talked to him, and his experience was he was still a lay person, not ordained as a monk yet, and he decided to go into the jungles of Java 38 years ago. It's very hard to find the jungles these days. There's so many people. There's still a few around. He went deep into the jungles just to meditate by himself, live off the fruits of the trees. And he said he was sitting down one day, the way he said, this big star came into him. Well, I like interesting the way he described it, just his way of perception. A big star came down. He said it was a deva, and he married that deva. That's what, you know, he said. What it was, nimitta, beautiful nimitta, and united with that nimitta, and went into the jhanas. He said when he came out afterwards, this was the interesting part of the story, it was actually days afterwards when he came out. You know, he's sitting there so still, so blissed out for, you know, quite a few days. And he noticed the surroundings had changed. There's a lot of destruction in the forest. And he checked afterwards with the villagers, yes, there'd been a big flood. And he worked out, there's no doubt about it, he'd been under maybe a meter or two of water, you know, for a day or two. No problem at all. So if there are any floods in your place, and there's no way out, quickly get into jhanas. And you'll be perfectly safe. If there's a really big bushfire down here in Jhana Grove, just get into to deep meditation into jhanas. And once the fire has burnt down the whole of Jhana Grove, then you'll get up. Not even your clothes would have been burnt. That would be really cool. Now the reason I say this, and this is absolutely true, if you get into jhana, you've got nothing to worry about at all. You are invulnerable. Literally. And okay, I mean, this is magic stuff, okay, but this is magic stuff which is true. Now, a lot of magic is superstition or just scams, but this is actually what happens. In those jhana states, you know, your body's got its own, I don't know how it works, its own protection system. So you can't get damaged or hurt at all. You're perfectly safe. More safe than when you're conscious of your body. So I say that, don't worry, your body is great. And if you do have any diseases or sicknesses, you come out of the jhanas and most of those are gone. These are powerful states of mind. It's actually good for your body. So that's why I'm saying this, so you don't have to be afraid. Oh, I'm letting my body go, no one's going to look after it. Now what's going to happen to it when I'm not supervising it? You don't have to worry. It's perfectly safe. And that's the bliss of the first jhana, is, you know, you just, your body is gone. Oh, what a relief. And you just feel so free, like a bird who can fly for a change, instead of being stuck to the ground like a human being, stuck to this body. This great sense of freedom. Second jhana. What happens is all these are lotus leaves, so this beautiful, incredible lotus leaf of the first jhana, it opens up. When it's ready, you get more still, a deeper stillness than the first jhana. And then you get to this other happiness. This is the happiness free of will. And there's something inside of you, always making choices, always having to make a choice. Should I get up? Should I sit down? Should I have a cup of tea or should I have a cup of chocolate? What should I do? Should I meditate more? Should I not meditate? I'm bored. Should I leave or should I stay? Should I do this? Oh, that. Sometimes that is a great irritation choice. That's why in the old days, when you go to a supermarket, you'd only have one cereal. These days, you get so many different types of cereals. When I used to go to a supermarket, there was only one type of milk. Now there's low-fat milk, there's low-fat plus something else milk, there's soya milk, there's rice milk, there's all sorts of brown milk and yellow milk. It's so hard to make choices. Have you not noticed that that's one of the great sufferings of our modern world? Choice. It gives you a headache. Imagine, all that will has totally vanished. You really are still, you can't make any choices anymore. You are free, perfectly still. not wanting anything, because you can't want anything. There's nothing to do the wanting anymore. That thing which we call will, choice, has now vanished. Yet a lot of people don't realize just what a pain in the ass will is. Of all the pains, will is the worst, and we celebrate it. We guard it like our deepest treasure. You know, the self-determination. There is no self. Somebody sent me this cartoon once of a Buddhist monastery with a cafeteria. All the young monks, they went to the self-service part. All the senior monks went to the no self-service part. You know, no self, okay. So no self-service. Now this is what happens when you sort of let go of the world. You get incredibly still. Now that's very weird. To be in a state you can't do anything, you can't move, you can't think, you can't do anything. Not because you don't want to, because you can't want not to, you can't want anything. All that wanting stuff has totally vanished. It's weird, the first time you've ever been in such a state. But my God, that's blissful. Ah, stillness at last. Have you ever come home from work really tired? Been rushing around all day, and you can sit down and do nothing. Now, that is your brain, your mind, rushing around, even if you're at home, rushing around doing this, doing that. At last, you're not even doing meditation anymore. You're perfect, you can't do anything, you're still at last. That is bliss. That's the bliss of the second jhanas. The bliss where everything, all the world has stopped. Now the next thing, it's hard to understand, it's a really weird state, but they're true, they're solid. The bliss vanishes. Bliss is an irritation. I know you're a little bit more peaceful now. There's two halves of bliss. We call it the piti and the sukha. The first course of heart vanishes. It's got this very peaceful happiness rather than the intensity. And that's the third jhana. Then even that bliss vanishes. And you're perfectly at peace, equanimous. The mind has become even more still, more empty, more free, which is the fourth jhana. It's very hard to explain these things simply because they are so far distant than ordinary life. But sometimes you have to go there many times and come back afterwards to actually realize what the heck is going on. But they're very powerful. You'll never have as much happiness ever as in those jhanas. And happiness is deeper happiness is the like of which you never thought could exist. Every one just more delightful. So if anything, monks and nuns who have deep meditation, we are the gourmets of pleasure. People have sex and think that's pleasure. That's like fast food, like going to McDonald's. We, instead of going to the fast food restaurants, we go to the top class restaurants. The one star restaurant of first jhana, the two star, the three Michelin star, the fourth Michelin star of the fourth jhana. Oh, just so delicious. The chefs in there are just so amazing. And the fifth star of, what can that be? The immaterials. So it's like different restaurants. And if you've eaten in a five-star restaurant, you can never eat in McDonald's again. It's crap. It's awful. What do I want to eat there for again? So this is what happens with the meditation. So it's all good stuff. And I like telling people this because sometimes monks, teachers, they are so condescending. They say, oh, you're lay people, no way can you do this, therefore we're not going to teach you. I was told in Vietnam, I don't know how many years ago, the whole Sangha had a meeting and they agreed not to teach jhanas to lay people. I thought, really, that was really off. I said, why? Because they won't attain it anyway. What's the point of teaching it? I said, no, they do attain it. Teach it, for goodness sake. Respect the people who feed you. So I'm teaching you everything. This is what jhanas are like. And if you teach people, you know what happens? Few of you attain it. If not now, later on. Why not? And at least you see the big picture. Even if you never do attain the jhanas, at least you know what they are and how they work. So you have the full picture of what this meditation is all about. And if you just get into the first jhana, you'll be one happy little Buddhist. And that makes me really, 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 really happy too. So you can have a taste of what it's like to be free. And with those experiences, I'll tell another talk another day. This is where you get great understanding of the Dhamma. If you really want insight, you just need these experiences. Totally different than what you've had before. So that is what the nimittas and jhanas are. And please, having said this, never ever think that you can't do it. You can. You will. It's only a matter of time. Especially, I know, once I put this message in, it's too late. You will, sooner or later. It's because people aren't taught, not even suggested, and then it never happens. The seed has been put inside of you. It's only a matter of time before it ripens. And you're sitting here one day, wow, 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 wow. And it just thinks the whole thing happens. And you're just a passenger, and you come out and go, wow, even me? And you come and say, yeah, even I did. And I said, I told you so. So that's the jhanas. Last thing before we finish off. Now I've mentioned those and how amazing they are and the fact that you can get these. Please don't want them. Oh, this is really good. Right, I'm going to get them this morning before this is it. Yeah, this is what I want. Right. Don't be stupid like that. Just carry on the way you were going before this talk. Just be still. Don't make too much effort. Make peace. Remember the causes. When you're still enough, it happens. Okay, so... Sadhu, powerful. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay.